I'm Tom Gentry. I'm a writer. I launched my first podcast in 2019. And for over 20 years, I've helped families struggling with addiction and related issues. I'm all about helping people reconnect with themselves and connect with others. I've spoken to men and women from many walks of life with the aim of getting to the essence of who they are. Along the way, I developed a set of questions to which even their closest friends may not know the answers. This show is my take on the Proust questionnaire. In each of these conversations, another human being offers us a small glimpse into their mind. They show us their heart, and in doing so, sometimes they touch ours. This is 20 Questions. Eric and I have known each other since about 1998, and we, I sometimes call him my old friend Eric because he's significantly older than me. And when we met, you know, I was just a young guy and he was approaching middle age, and I'm being a little bit, I'm exaggerating a bit, but I'm just having fun. So he was a counselor at this addiction treatment facility where I got an entry-level position, and we just became friends. And one of my favorite stories about that is I'd been working there per diem occasionally for a while, and then I started doing this job where I worked Thursday, Friday night, Saturday, Sunday day. And so I was never there when all the suits were there. And there was an opening that came up during the day, and I'm like 25. And I remember Eric asking me if I was going to apply for the job. And I was like, I don't know, man, do you think I can make it with these serious people? And he's like, absolutely, man. But that's how little I saw in myself at that point. So I thank God I've had people like Eric to believe in me. So anyway, so let's get this thing started. You ready to do this?
Yes.
All right. If your life were a novel, what would be the title?
Oh, my God. it's funny. Like, I was looking at some of the questions, and I stopped in the middle of it because I realized what I was doing was that would be my attempt to think of like a clever thing to say for, you know, like a clever answer to all these questions. And whenever I attempt to do that, it always like goes sideways for me. I feel like I'm always like better. I'm always at my best when I'm just trying to be spontaneous and direct. If my life were a novel, what would it be called?
Yeah.
All right. I think it would be like a self-help book, and I would call it The Path to Happiness, Embracing the Doofus Within.
Yeah. Well, what about maladaptive behavior? We've been talking about this behavior thing.
Yeah, that probably would be better. Let's scratch the first answer. Let's go with maladaptive behavior. That's actually a cool title for a book.
It is. Yeah. Where were you born?
I was born in Huntington, New York.
And where's the place you call home?
I live in Delray Beach.
When you were a kid, what did you want to be when you grew up?
A homicide detective.
Okay. And what is your profession?
I am a psychotherapist.
What profession other than your own would you like to attempt?
A homicide detective.
Seriously?
Yeah, I honestly, that's more of a fantasy thing, but I just always thought there was something really cool about law enforcement. And the first books I ever read were from my dad's collection of novels. And it was this author by the name of Joseph Wambaugh, who was really the first to, he was really one of the first to ever write like these kind of detective police novels, mm-hmm. which, you know, that genre has become huge and there's a million other people that do it now, but he was like the first. Mm-hmm. And a couple of his books became movies, and I can't think of off the top of my head, but they're probably, Tom, if I told you a name or two of them, you would be familiar with them. You would know the movies.
Well, I'm not going to say anything about donuts or anything, but I could see you in a policeman's uniform for sure.
No, man. The homicide detective is plain clothes.
Yeah, but still. What's your favorite quote?
It's Irving Yalom. And the quote is, "Each of us must decide how much truth he can stand."
What's your favorite movie?
There are a few. Oh man, that's tough. I would say, yeah, there's a few of those. There's probably like 10, really. They're up for all different reasons. That's hard to answer, but I can give you, obviously I think the Godfather 1 is way up there. Yeah, there's that. There's a movie called Ordinary People. What else is really up there? Yeah, you know what? There's so many. It's tough to say. I wish I could give you a better answer than that.
Yeah, that was great. You know, there's one movie you turned me on to a long time ago. It's one of the first movies that Jennifer Aniston was in, Edward Burns movie called She's the One.
Yeah, that's great.
If anybody wants a good, funny movie that's somewhat obscure that they probably haven't seen before, that's a good one. Favorite song?
Man, that's another really tough one. I would say, all right, from the John Lee Hooker live album, the one live at Cafe Agogo, and I think it's like Folsom Prison, or one of the it might not have been Folsom Prison, it's one of the prisons in California. Boogie Everywhere I Go. It's like an amazing.
That should be the name of your novel, dude.
Boogie Everywhere, yeah. I Go.
I had a feeling it was going to be John Lee Hooker. Mine's Whiskey and Women of his. If you don't know John Lee Hooker, there's nothing like John Lee Hooker.
So if you can imagine him playing, just going off, and he's in a prison in the 1960s, where I don't think they get a lot of really good entertainment there, right. And they recorded this live, and it's really like they're doing like a lot of improv blues, but like electric blues, and the guys are going nuts, and you can hear them, you know. It's a pretty incredible performance.
All right. Do you have a favorite work of art?
You know, I think I'd probably sound a lot more sophisticated and intelligent if I did, but I do not.
Well, thanks for being real with us.
Something by Van Gogh. I don't know.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm not really much of an art collector.
Okay. Who do you admire most?
Who do I admire most? I mean, you know, again, I don't want to twist it. I admire lots of different people for different reasons, right? Like I have, I'm fans and that kind of, you know, like I get a lot of motivation from the stories of other people. I'll tell you, the person that really I'm inspired by currently is a guy by the name of Francis Ngannou. And Francis Ngannou is actually the current heavyweight champion of the UFC. And this is a guy who comes from Cameroon. and at the age of 10 was working in a sand mine. This is like something out of the movie. He was working out of a sand mine, and he had to, cross the desert like four times and got sent back and ended up in Morocco and got sent back and put in jail. Like his odyssey to get from Cameroon to eventually Paris, where he was put in jail for a period of time and then was released and was homeless. His odyssey to go from living in abject poverty in Cameroon to traveling across the desert to ending up in Morocco to ultimately becoming to being able to train in Paris with, he was discovered by a boxing coach and then got like elite. They noticed his, they recognized his talent like right away. And the guy became an elite boxer and mixed martial artist. And he's now like the heavyweight champion. It's a pretty incredible story. So of all the personal stories that I've heard in recent times, that's the one that is jumping out for me right now.
All right. So over the course of your life, what's an issue with which you have repeatedly struggled?
There are two that kind of really jump out. I guess one of them is just kind of anxiety, just generalized. I've been working on this my whole life, and really at moments, just not being able to see how optimistic and full of opportunities my future actually is, and just being stuck with worry and making up stories about things that ultimately never really come to pass, and creating problems that don't exist. Anxiety, is probably the biggest. And the other is, sad to say, I have had a bad blind spot for giving allegiance to exploitive people, I've put trust in the wrong people, and it's always like the same type of person, and I've left myself open to exploitation, in business and in my personal life by doing that, and it's cost me, but I'd like to think at this point I've learned that lesson, and I'm not bound to repeat it any further.
Yeah. Well, obviously, I've had to learn that lesson too, a time or two. And we have some shared experience in that area.
Yeah. Just being overly trusting of certain, being overly trusting of, ingratiating and charming people and not learning from the mistakes, but I think I've got it now.
Yeah, I think you do. All right. Switching gears here. In your childhood, who was your celebrity crush?
My celebrity crush during Ethel Merman? No, I'm just kidding. Who would have been my celebrity? You know what? Dude, it's hard to remember back that far.
Think Charlie's Angels, Three's Company. That's probably the time we're talking about, right?
Yeah. I think, honestly, I know it's kind of lame because everybody from my generation, but probably Farrah Fawcett.
Yeah. Did you have that poster of her with the red bathing suit?
I didn't. That my mother and that would have never been permitted. Right. Nothing like that would have ever been permitted in our home. Mm-hmm. But Farrah was I thought she was pretty cool.
Yeah. What historical figure would you most like to meet?
again, that's a pretty long list. You know, how far back are we going? Just
wherever you want. I mean, you know, it's your answer to this question.
Well, okay. In reference to our conversation that we were having the other day about Marco Polo,
mm-hmm.
I think I would, you know, I would have liked to have met, like, I think it would have been cool to meet, like, Genghis Khan, but not, you know what I mean?
Like, you wouldn't want to be a prisoner or anything, though, right?
Yeah, exactly. Or, you know what I mean? Like, maybe a Zoom call. Like maybe a Zoom call with Genghis Khan. But I don't know if I wanted a face to face with him.
Yeah, probably not.
But right. I don't know. I mean, I think, what is it? I mean, when you think about, I don't know that there's ever been anybody in history who had that kind of unbridled ambition where you just basically like conquered a third of the world in that time period. You know, I mean, I don't know. There's just so many fascinating people. I think I probably wasted, you know what, man? I probably more than that, honestly. I mean, who wouldn't have wanted to, like, who from my profession wouldn't have wanted to sit down with someone like Carl? I would have more rather wanted to sit down with someone like Carl Jung. Mm-hmm. That actually probably more so Carl Jung.
You'd choose Jung over Freud?
Yeah, I would. I mean, he's just
more likable, you know?
Well, just that whole, like to talk to him about archetypes and the collective unconscious and all of those things and where those ideas came from. Like, I would really want to know about that and talk to him about those things. Like his inspiration for the book, like Man and His Symbols and all those things. Like I would want to know. I would really want to sit and talk to him about those things. There are also probably people from Native America as well. And obviously, I mean, you know, I worked for the Seminole Indians for 10 years and have a deep, like, love of the culture and the people and the tribe and all that. So I would have loved to, like, an opportunity to sit with Osceola, mm-hmm. who I believe, you know, had pretty good English, pretty good English. So to sit with him, I think, would have been pretty amazing as well.
Yeah, Tecumseh would have been another one, too.
You know what? That comes to mind, but I mean, Osceola and it would have, if you're given a choice.
Well, you know his descendants, so.
Yeah, I do. Some of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. What natural gift or ability would you most like to possess?
Like a natural, like not a supernatural ability, well, but like a natural.
Go wherever you want with this, man. They're your questions.
I guess, you know, it's a toss up between like elite athletic ability and the ability to see the future. You know, those two things, I think.
It's interesting that you've struggled with anxiety and you'd really like to be able to see the future.
Oh, yeah, it is. Well, and again, that speaks to, because the first thought is if you could see the future, you can kind of control everything.
You wouldn't have to worry anymore.
About anything, right?
All right. What do you consider your greatest achievement?
I think, you know, there are a few, honestly. I think, you know, really, man, like if I look at it, I think my greatest achievement really is my life, right? Like in totality, because it going back, when I was a kid in, you know, elementary school, I was not someone who had like a lot, you know, I was diagnosed with a learning disability really early, like first grade. And I developed from that point like this terrible low self-esteem, and it followed me, you know. I couldn't even pinpoint it. I just never really expected much from myself and never really expected to accomplish much. And that was just a thing that kind of, it just becomes your reality. You just sort of anticipate that that's what my life was going to be. So the fact that I'm at this place where I have, where I'm an educated person with a master's degree, that I am accomplished in my work, that I have a successful business, a successful private practice, that I have a, you know, that I'm happily married, that I'm a homeowner, that I, you know, I have a child, and I feel like as a father, like done a good job raising my son, have a great relationship with him, and have, you know, done all those things. And when I look at it as a whole, if you would have asked me at 15 years old, you know, did I think I was capable of these things, that I was going to go and do these things? I thought these were things that other people could do, and I probably couldn't. So the fact that I've gotten here and that I'm at this place, like all of it together, that's really the achievement that I'm most proud of is my, just my life itself, that I've just gotten to this place. And I don't take it lightly or say it with hubris. It's actually with a lot of gratitude that I got, that I'm here.
Yeah, absolutely.
That I have friends that, like, seriously, like when you think that you would actually think enough of me, that with all this investment you've made in your podcast and all this stuff that you do on, you know, Clubhouse and this whole thing that you're doing, that you would actually, that I am actually someone you would want to talk to here, that you'd think that this would be good for, to talk to me and hear what I'd have to say and answer these questions. Like, all of that is really what I'm most proud of. The people around me,
yeah,
you know, too. It's all part of it.
Right. All right. What quality do you admire most in a person?
You know, there are a lot. I really like creative people. I like people who have like original ideas and bring them to life. I've always like just in, whether it be art, music, writing, or the ability to bring something creative to life in business. I just find all of that fascinating. Like I like listening to people talk about the things that they're doing, that they're passionate about, that they're building or creating. That whole thing in people that seeks to create or evolve something new, like anybody who's trying to do something, build something, create something, write something, make a movie, a story, like a podcast, whatever it is. If I meet that person, I'll sit with that person at Starbucks and I'll give that person a lot of my time to hear about what they're doing. You know, I like creative people, and I like people who are, and I also like people who are benevolent towards others, like people who are like kind and do things for other people, people who try to like lift up other people. I think that those two things, like being able to create stuff and having unique vision and being able to build things, and people who like do for other people, like people who are just good to other people. It feels good to be around people like that.
Yeah. What's something you'd like to learn about?
The learning is really more like to improve the things that I'm already doing, you know, like I would like to be a better musician. I would like to be a better therapist. I want to like the stuff that you and I are working on. Like I want to be good at recording and creating and editing interviews, you know. I guess just basically to, you know, martial arts, to improve at that. So the hobbies and the things that I like and that I want to do, they're already, you know, the vocations, the passions that I want are already in front of me. I just want to be better at all of them, learn more and improve in each of them, really. Probably about five different things.
I admire that quality in you. All right. What do you wish more people knew about you?
I don't know that I need that. I guess I just wish I knew more people. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like I wish that more people knew I existed, you know. this would really be, you know, they're just like expanding my reach into the world and knowing more people to interact with on all different levels.
I'm thinking like, of an ad campaign. Like,
yeah,
I'm here.
I just like knowing people. Like, I don't need the world to be like, you guys all need to see my music. You know, I was like, I don't have anything like that, that I wish the world knew about me. I feel like I show up okay as I am. I just, you know, I guess really more just wish I knew more people. It was involved with more people.
All right. Well, you know, these are new people right now.
Yeah. Doing the things that I like to do with other people.
Hmm. All right. What's your idea of success?
I think to me, success, I mean, it's pretty corny because it's really, you've heard this before. I don't have anything to add to that, but I think I think people who get paid to do the stuff that they like to do, like if you're a person who really likes your work and that's a blessing, because I've known a lot of like affluent and successful people who just hated their jobs. And you know, it's funny, like I think a lot of people would envy them for what they have, but they're really not happy people. And I would take a more modest income to do what you really, really like to do and be happy doing it, and you know, think that your work is cool and to be excited about it. And if you get paid well to do that, that's even better. Like if you have both, I think you're a really successful person. Like if you get paid well and have everything you need and you're doing like what you want to do and you're happy with your work, I think that that's an exceptional level of success. Hmm.
All right, last question. What would you like people to say about you when you're gone?
I'm kind of hoping that I have a pretty big funeral, Tom. I'm, you know what I mean? Like I'm hoping it'll be, you know, I'm hoping I get a good, I think I'm going to have a pretty good turnout there. I'm hoping to. What I want people to say about me when I'm gone, my hope is that it would be measured in impact, that the people that were left behind me, you know, they're thinking of me, were like, that the conversation would be like, this guy helped me, taught me, gave me, like his, that my presence here, my involvement with people, my involvement with friends, family, colleagues, that I contribute something to them, that I was viewed as like generous in partnership that way, that I like gave and helped people, and that they viewed me as, hey, you know what? Eric helped me do this, or Eric contributed this to my life, or Eric was there for me maybe when I needed him, like those kinds of things. Like I do like to be thought well of. Like I want people to see me as someone who contributed something positive to the world and really positive to people.
Yeah. Well,
that does matter to me.
I'll share with everybody. And guys, raise your hand. Come up if you want. I mean, I'd love to have you and have a little discussion here. Maybe we can have a topic. And maybe we talk about this, how we impact other people or who has impacted us in our lives. Because, you know, as Eric is saying this, what I'm thinking about is how, I don't know, maybe 2007, 2008, Eric was somebody who I had this job where I would call him for guidance, you know, sort of informal supervision. And he did a group in this community that I was managing. And so he knew what was happening, and he also knew my boss. And so I'd have a lot of these conversations with him on my way into work in the morning. And one day he said to me, you know, you're really too good at this to not have any credentials. And if there's something I can do to help you with that, I will. And at that point, I had taken all the coursework 10 years before and started an internship, but never finished it. And that's the effect that Eric had on my life and my career. Part of it, I wouldn't be an addiction counselor if it wasn't for you. I wouldn't. So thank you for that. And yeah, this is awesome, man. I've enjoyed this.
I want to say something to you, Tom. I don't know. You know what, man? It's been a long time that I've known you, and I probably, you know, you get to be in your 50s, and you know, I become that dude who starts repeating stories and shit. Like, you know what I mean? Like, you forget what you told to. But so if you go back to like when you and I were working together at the Hanley Center, you know, and I was a new therapist there, and you were, you know, the like weekend behavioral tech, and you were, you know, like that whole thing you were saying about like, do I want to work there during the day with all the suits and the administrative people? Like, do I, you know, all that? I want to tell you what you represented to me at that time. And I say this with a great deal of sincerity. So if you think about like the whole South Florida treatment landscape, my first job out of school was at the National Recovery Institute. And I was, I was a counselor there, and that place shut down because of, really they were committing insurance fraud, and it was really public. It was, thank God they didn't have much internet back then. This was like 95 or something. This was like 99. The place shut down because of insurance fraud, and it was really public. It was in the newspapers, and everybody knew about it. It was really embarrassing, and so the place went bankrupt, and the owners were brought up on like, you know, charges and the whole thing. And I left there, and I was thinking to myself, this thing is going to put a blight on my record. Like, this is going to put a blight on my, like, I'm going to be untouchable after working for these people. And what was I involved with, you know, working in addiction recovery? I mean, is this really somewhat thing you want to do? Do you want to work in, you know, this residential South Florida residential treatment where these, you know, shady places, and they're getting shut down for insurance fraud? And is this actually even helping people, you know, 'cause you wonder about that. And then I go to work at the Hanley Center. I was fortunate to get to work there because it's a place with a really good reputation. So I was grateful to get a job with them, because I didn't know that that was going to be possible for me, you know, to help kind of help me move myself forward after this terrible, you know, move out of the starting gate. And I met you, and you were a guy who I was interested in you. You were a guy who was treated at the Hanley Center. Like, you went through treatment there, and you kind of followed the program, like how it works, of, you know, you go and you get sober, and you take these recovery jobs, and you amass time in sobriety. And then, you know, you had worked as a like a manager at the transitional house, the halfway house that you were living at, and you just kind of slowly but surely elevated yourself, and now you were working at the Hanley Center. And I'm looking at you, you know, this kid from Indiana who came all this way to go to treatment in Florida, and and at this point you're a couple of years sober, you're working for the Hanley Center, you have prospects, people are offering you opportunities, you know, they want you to come work for days. And to me, I know what that means. You're on track because you're going to be doing stuff with them. You know, you were picked, and eventually you were going to be having more opportunities. You were just that person. And when I saw it and I actually knew somebody, you know, somebody I knew was actually going through that process, and you see it and you're like, oh, okay, this is what it looks like. This is what it looks like when somebody succeeds in this whole, like, model, this whole program, this whole system. This is what somebody's life looks like. Like, they end up sober with job opportunities. They get to kind of really full access to their abilities. People see them as that. They get opportunities. You know, you get a cool apartment in West Palm Beach, and dating and doing all the things. And I'm like, that's really what you're part of. That's what success looks like. And there are other people doing it too. And it's not a bad job to have. It's not a bad field to work in, because it's working. And you were really the first person I had seen, knew well, that had like gone through that process, you know, and was young in it. And it really did convince me more than anyone I had met up to that point. I mean, I've heard some amazing stories, you know, and met people who were 20 years sober and all of that stuff, but I didn't know any of them as well as I knew you. And it was really, it had an impact on me in terms of like believing in the whole process, you know, and seeing that what my part in that could be.
Wow.
That was a long speech. I don't think that was one of the questions that you asked either.
It was fine, man. I appreciate it. No, it's nice because I always think about our relationship. I always think about what I've gotten from it. And just to know that, I mean, what you're saying is that I was able to show you that the work you did was something you could be proud of. And that makes me happy to hear. So thank you for sharing that with me. Whew. All right. So we got Adam up here, who's Eric's best friend. Adam, how you doing?
Good, gentlemen. How are you? Great show today.
Thank you. Thank you.
Enjoying it a lot.
So you should praise Eric. What do you have to say about him, Adam?
I have no praise for Eric. None. actually, Eric, I do have a question for you. You know, that now that you're in private practice for at least a year or so, you know, or made the change, like, what has been the biggest thing you've learned, I guess, or has changed with your theory now that you're working in private practice?
It's interesting. I think the difference with private practice and that's a really good question, Adam. I think the difference in private practice with agency work is that you really have to employ a lot more flexibility in the way that you conceptualize the work that you're doing. And you really have to lean into the idea of self-determination, that people show up and they have their own vision of their own lives. And, you know, they have their own vision of their own lives. They're trying to get to a place that they're trying to get to. And that it's really not that my, you know, and you got to work with people where they're at. And often people have very different ideas, you know, about the lives that they're trying to live. And so that whole idea of, you know, where it challenges your sense of moral relativity and values and kind of values differences that you have between yourself and the person in front of you and all those different things, it all gets challenged. But to me, I think the greatest in terms of like the impact of practice itself is that, you have to employ a lot more flexibility in terms of the way you conceptualize these situations and realize that these people are coming to you, you know, of their own choice. And there are lots of people they can go talk to, but they're coming to you. So, you know, you have to respect that space in that way, I think. I don't know if that makes any sense.
Yeah, that was great. Yeah, I think so. And I think for me as well, Eric, you know, one of the things that you changed with my life was when I had not planned on getting licensed, and somewhere in the early 2000s when we were working again together, you're like, why aren't you getting licensed? So you then pushed me to take the test and go forward and finish that. And so I appreciate that as well.
Oh yeah, man. I remember that. Thank you. Thank you. Well, you know, Adam, like for me, like with the private practice thing, I mean, and I've told you this before, so this isn't gonna be new information for you, but like, you are the model. You are the person. I mean, I've seen other people who had private practices, but you were the first person I saw who was kind of like at my same level in agencies that went and did it successfully. And from the first day, it was really my goal to kind of emulate and kind of copy, you know, like you sort of like, I'm not trying to reinvent the wheel. I watched you do it. And it's like, that's the successful path, you know, even to renting in the same building, starting with one of the little tiny offices downstairs that you can get for super cheap, working part-time in an agency while you build the practice. Then once you can go full-time, moving upstairs, getting a bigger office, you know, that kind of like I followed all of those steps as I had watched you do it 10 years before. So like you really kind of created the model and it inspired the fact that this thing could be done, that it was possible, that I knew somebody else who did it. And you encouraged me, you know, like they say, you get by with a little help from your friends, you know? Yeah, man. So you, both of you guys in different ways, like have been a huge help to me, you know, and continue to be, right?
Yeah. I was going to say, I just sent you a referral like 2 days ago.
Yeah. Thank you, man. And I appreciate that. I appreciate that. And it's, you know, and too, like, I'm inspired, man. Like, I never want to stop. Like, I never want to be comfortable, you know, like, that's what kind of like what the podcast is about. It's sort of like the next level of how am I going to challenge myself to keep doing and creating and, you know, stuff.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, I mean, just to have had the opportunity to work with both you guys has been a treat. I feel really blessed with the people I have in my life, and you guys are definitely at the tippity top of that list, especially given, you know, in the industry we work in, you know, it's just been great. So
same back at you.
Yeah. Leslie, how are you? Thank you for coming up.
Hi, thank you so much for bringing me up on stage. I'm not sure how I can really add to this amazing conversation, but I wanted to come up and just say, Eric, I just loved what you said. The measured in impact so resonated so deeply with me, because for me, I think that anything that we do, especially if you're heart-centered, that you really want to help people, that it comes from that place where it's not about you. You know that it's not about you. And you know that when you take your last breath, that you want to make sure that you left the place where you were a better place than from the moment you stepped in and took your first breath in the world. So I love that measured in impact. Thanks, Tom, for bringing me into this room. I wanted to ask you guys a question, because I'm realizing now more and more what you all are doing with your lives, how you are impacting the people in your lives. I actually have a younger brother who is an alcoholic and has been for at least 30 years. I'm guessing that's about right. And I think my question would be, I didn't see it coming because I never really had any real exposure to that kind of life until I started, when it was too late to start seeing the signs. And so I see how, like, he still lives at home with my mom, who is now in her almost mid 80s. And I can see the toll that it's taking on her mentally. So what would be your advice for someone who doesn't really have that background like you do to help in, I don't know if it's helping my family be able to manage these emotions, because I know he has these up and down emotions, and a lot of it comes from him saying truths that I believe he wants to be his truth, but he's not really living that. And so how does someone navigate that from a family member who doesn't know really how to deal? That's my question. So thank you. I'm Leslie on Complete.
I'm sure there's probably a few people in here who have different answers. And, you know, Leslie, that's that question that you're asking, it could be, I think we could probably all eight of us, you know, people in the room could respond to that and give you different answers, and all eight people would be right. My suggestion to you, my small suggestion is, I think with a lot of people and alcoholism and family members, when it gets to a chronic place like that, a lot of times people give up on family members. And I think that first and foremost, recognizing that just maintaining contact and staying in that person's life is that, you know, there's always hope, right? There's always hope, and that if you maintain a presence in that person's life allows for the possibility that someday, it may not be today, it may not be tomorrow, but if that person's ready to reach out with the question of what can I do, that you'll be there. And it sounds like you're that person. So I think that that's one piece, is just when you have someone in your life that's kind of chronic like that, just maintaining a presence, because a lot of times, you know, after years of this, people give up on people like that. So if you're there, you're already doing something. Because if he does motivate it to change someday, it may be you that gets the call, you know. The other thing is, usually in situations like this, and I don't know if it's the case with your brother, on the almost kind of like the inverse of what I just said, is that a lot of times when you have that identified alcoholic in the family, people start setting a lower and lower bar for that person. And often there's a dependency that exists where somebody in the family is enabling. I don't know if you've got that going on. I don't know if there's somebody else that's kind of like propping him up that enables, you know, that I don't know if there's anybody else that's creating a barrier between him and the natural consequences of his lifestyle. If that will, because you mentioned about your mom. And so in my mind, I'm thinking like, what is mom doing stuff for him? Paying his rent, having him live at her house, you know, handling his stuff. I don't know that that exists or not, if he's an independent guy. I mean, there's a lot we don't know to speculate specifically. But I would say that, you know, people in your brother's space, if there's people propping him up and preventing him from experiencing some of these natural consequences, we have to start looking at that may not actually be the most helpful thing you can do for him. You know, so it's that combination of being there and being ready to listen and not abandoning someone who has these problems, and also that fine line of not enabling them at the same time. And you know, there comes a time too, Leslie, where sometimes family members and family members and people that are close to an alcoholic, we have to kind of realize that we've developed our own sort of emotional condition that's separate from their condition, which would be what we call like codependency. And that might be something we have to address within ourselves, because, well, that creates a whole cascade of, you know, problems and complications within our own life if we're become preoccupied with caretaking for people with alcoholism and substance use disorders, because those substance use disorders can become very consuming in terms of what they take away from the life of the person with the substance use disorder and anybody in their orbit. So that's my thought on that.
Wow. So I have to tell you, hit everything on the head, the nail on the head for everything, because yes, of course, I'll never ever abandon anyone in my family, regardless of whatever they do, whatever they've done. I feel he has so much potential. I still feel he has so much potential, regardless of where he's at in his life right now. But I do know that part of his, I feel the reason why it hasn't really helped, he hasn't really been helped to move forward, is that he, even though I thought he might have hit his rock bottom moment, I don't believe he ever really got to fully feel into that moment, because my mom has always been there to pick him back up every single time. And I think there is that codependency, like you were saying. It's her not wanting to be alone because she lives alone. She's elderly, and vice versa. She's also complaining about having to take care of him, but then it's also having someone there. So there is this dependent relationship for her wanting him there. I think she has enabled him. I've had this conversation with her many times, but again, it's her youngest. And so that's her baby. And I can't imagine what it would be like to be a parent, because we never had children, my husband and I, but I can only imagine that as a parent, when it's your child and when they're hurting, you sometimes won't take those necessary steps to let them fall down and get back up on their own, because you want to be there to pick them back up. So you really hit the nail on the head. I appreciate that you chimed in and tell me all of this, because it helps me to feel like I can get an understanding that I'm not like imagining these things happening, like with my mom and him, this relationship that kind of is, it's not so much that it's kind of toxic in a way, because she's not helping him, but he's not helping himself. And again, he'll say things like he's sober, and then I'll have a conversation with him and I can't understand a word he's saying, which I know then he has been drinking. So I still won't judge, but I'll still be there. But then again, it's like, how do I help someone, especially my mom too, right? Because she is depending. She's codependent, but she's also enabling. And it's like, how do you, this is like a double-edged sword for me to be there, but to also try to not allow myself to set those, like you said, setting those low bars. But again, you know, it's kind of hard to navigate this in this place, but still be open to those conversations. So I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Well, you know, one thing about this is, you know, nobody ever knows how to do this. And, you know, it's families need help with stuff like this. And first of all, I want to tell you that, I'm happy to talk to you. So I'll DM you my number. But one of the things that I've started doing over the last few years is to consult with families who are in this situation to help them sort of orchestrate the change. You know, what strategies they can use to sort of create a scenario where the person might think they have a choice, but they don't really have a choice anymore. Or there's only one attractive choice. All the other ones are unattractive. And I just a couple weeks ago did an episode of my podcast with this father who I worked with a couple years ago to help him and his wife help his 28-year-old son. So check that out. And I'm happy to talk to you. And I guess the first thing that comes to mind when somebody in your position poses questions to me like this is to not underestimate the value of actually just getting help for yourself right away, to get guidance from people, on how to deal with this. But I appreciate you, being transparent about it. And, you know, I'm living proof that recovery is possible, and so are other people in here. So thank you. And I look forward to getting you up here to ask you these questions, which we'll do. And I'll be following up with you about that. But Jenna, how you doing?
Good. Hi, everyone. My name's Jenna. Leslie, I love that you talked about that because I actually have a brother who is in active addiction. And he's been in active addiction for like 10 to 15 years. And I'm actually a recovering alcoholic. So I know what you're feeling. And it's hard. And honestly, Eric, when you said the thing about hope, I'm like, oh my God, my hope is like friggin' dwindling. But yeah, I always think of attraction, not promotion. Like, I live a good life now. I'm sober. And I hope that someday I do keep it open. Like, I find it hard to hang out with him when he's all fucked up. I don't know. I see it like Leslie kind of sees it. It's like I'm enabling him in a way. But yeah, I really like that. And Eric, I just wanted to say, I did my master's in counseling and I actually quit during my placement. So Tom and you are a great inspiration. And honestly, like, yeah, it's really nice to listen in on this type of topic. So thank you.
Thank you so much. That's awesome. I hope you get back out there, you know? And I appreciate both of your feedback on that.
Yeah, Jenna's got a big heart. She's going to help a lot of people. She already is helping a lot of people. So, well, this has been fantastic, man. Memory lane a little bit, and I just really appreciate you, Eric, and, you know, I love you. I do, man. I really do. And I'm excited about this project we're working on together, and I'm excited that we get to do something together on our own terms, and I'm really optimistic about how it's going to play out for you. Probably what I love most about it is how happy I see it making you, and how I see that it's an opportunity for you to be fulfilled, at least more fulfilled creatively. And it's gonna be great. It's gonna be fantastic. So it's called Good Counsel, the Helping People's Podcast. So it's gonna be a podcast for not only therapists, but all sorts of healers. And right now, the first episode, the first season is we're looking at the beginning of the year, but Eric's right in the middle of, doing the interviews and piecing it all together. So it's going to be really cool. I appreciate you guys supporting me here. So 25 years ago, right now, I was on my way to jail. And, I had this really difficult conversation with my dad where I just cried to him and, was just coming to terms with the fact that I was an alcoholic. And, so it's just awesome to be able to have this conversation with you, Eric, right now. I always get like all caught up in feelings and memories at this time of year. And, I'm definitely grateful to be sober and grateful for the people in my life. And, I love you guys. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. I mean, that's really great, man. And, you know, I care for you and, you know, the world. And, Yeah, man, I am deeply moved by the whole thing. I didn't see all that coming. You know, it's a really funny thing how these conversations have a way of taking a turn, and the different things that you end up getting into, and you know who you end up talking to, and meeting and stuff. But I really appreciate you bringing me into this and having me on today. It was honestly, man, as with everything else that we've done, or that you've invited me into, it has exceeded my expectations as far as how rich it all is and how good it feels just to be doing it.
Yeah, thank you for saying that. I appreciate it. And I feel the same way. It's always better than I think it's going to be. Thanks for listening to the show. Please take the time to subscribe at Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Check out the latest episode of The Path to Authenticity at thepathtoauthenticity.com. You can also find the podcast club on Clubhouse, or you can join the podcast community for access to supplemental content at patreon.com/thepathtoauthenticity.